Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God. And ladies and gentlemen, we are in need of an owner's manual at a moment such as this. You need to know who is doing what. Well, to us in some cases, but also to friends and allies of ours, notably the state of Israel, and to what effect, to what dire effect, not just for friends like the Israelis, but also, I believe, for us. If, as seems now to be increasingly likely, our government, the Biden administration, abandons the state of Israel and throws in fully, unmistakably, with those determined to save Hamas, her mortal enemy, yes, but I believe ours as well, especially when seen in the light of its alliances with the Hezbollah and the Houthi rebels and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the regime in Tehran and so on. These are our enemies, ladies and gentlemen, and the Israelis are fighting them. We have an interest in helping them do that on our behalf as well as their own. A man who understands all of this as well as anybody in America, I believe, is my friend, my colleague, and our indispensable resource at the Center for Security Policy, who runs our Mideast program there. His name is Dr. David Wormser. He's certainly no stranger to this audience, but we're always delighted to be able to catch up with him and take stock of what is happening, because it seems every day, if not every hour, there is some new development that needs parsing and is, unfortunately, generally, it seems, moving in the wrong direction. David Wormser has a wealth of experience to draw on in making these analyses and his insights and recommendations, including as a naval intelligence officer. He rose through the ranks to a lieutenant commander in the United States Navy. He also has served at the highest levels of the government in positions aiding Undersecretary of State, a national security advisor, the vice president of the United States, not least. And we're delighted to be advised by him as well. Welcome back, David. It's good to have you with us, sir.
So it's always good to be with you, Frank.
Thank you. Well, only because it's a mutual therapy session, I suppose, get some things off our chest. Yes. But David, let's talk a little bit about the latest signals being sent by the administration. Apparently, they're being amplified by the Israeli press at the moment concerning this idea of an immediate ceasefire. What's going on?
Yeah, the American position until now had essentially been that the ceasefire is the price Israel's going to have to pay to get its hostages, or at least some of its hostages, back. So it was literally hostages for ceasefire. And then the prisoners, the terrorists in jail in Israel, were an additional part of that. All of a sudden, what we're hearing is that the United States is now focused on the ceasefire. And it isn't using the ceasefire to get the hostages back. It's using the ceasefire to get a ceasefire. And the hostages back, I think, are what they're trying to still give the Israelis to make it palatable. But the focus at the UN, from what I'm hearing from the Israeli press right now, is that the United States has sequenced it, which means we want a ceasefire, and then in the framework of the ceasefire, the Israelis and Hamas need to work toward a resolution that frees the hostages. Of course, that takes away all the leverage Israel has in the negotiations for the hostages, and essentially leaves Israel facing a unilaterally imposed ceasefire or a multilaterally imposed ceasefire on it for nothing. Yeah. For the right
on it Hamas. Exclusively, though.
On it for the right to talk to Hamas about getting its hostages freed.
Yeah, and those talks have not gone so well the last time I checked. And even when the price, and I'm very glad you made the point, the price involves so-called prisoners, but who are actually terrorists, jihadists, who once released will go back into the ranks of the jihadis who have been waging war on Israel, make no mistake about it. And sometimes the ratios have been as high as, what, 10 to 1 or more hostages for jihadis. I mean, this sounds like a complete betrayal of the Israelis by the United States government. Is that overstating it?
It is. I mean, the United States essentially now has taken the position of the BDS movement, the Students for Justice in Palestine movement, in the United States, essentially with the people who are out there demonstrating in the universities and violent against our Christmas celebrations, demanded, which is a ceasefire, a unilateral, a full ceasefire, an end of war scenario. And the United States...
Wait a moment. There still is at least this fiction that it will be a temporary ceasefire, isn't there?
Publicly, but privately, American diplomats have told their Arab interlocutors, the Qataris, the Egyptians, the idea is to get Israel involved in a long enough ceasefire that it makes it impossible for Israel to resume the conflict afterwards.
So that would be essentially the effect of a ceasefire of the kind of duration that they're talking about now. Is there still some 6-week length to it, or has that been over the side as well?
Well, they're saying about six, somewhere around 6 weeks is the draft currently being circulated. And then beyond that, that then leads to a longer term ceasefire, which obviously would be end of war. And really what's driving the United States now is no longer, well, I'm not sure it ever really was concern for the hostages or fully supporting Israel in its war to eliminate this awful terrorist organization. Where I think the United States is coming down is we're freaking out. We're literally in a panic over Ramadan and this idea that the war could continue into Ramadan without a ceasefire, and that the Arab world will go up in flames against the United States and Israel, and the war will get out of hand. It's a form of the Arab street argument that we always hear and never proves correct, but is certainly accepted as given fact by...
I guess, David, the question is it the Arab street or is it the Arabs in the American streets that the administration is now most concerned about, especially after... you know, the 100,000 or so, and they're not all Arab Americans or Muslims, but presumably most of them were in Michigan, who, you know, filed their vote for uncommitted, and there are other states in which a similar kind of protest movement is underway. So, I mean, is this really about the Middle East any longer, or do you think that it's increasingly domestic politics that are driving the administration to abandon its rhetorical support for Israel?
Yeah, I think there's definitely, and the administration doesn't even hide it all that much, or at least the people surrounding the administration don't hide it that much, that they believe the Arab vote, the progressive Arab vote in narrow sections of Michigan are the make or break of the entire Democratic Party and President Biden's ability to be reelected. So there definitely is out there a sense that his domestic political electoral agenda trumps our alliance with Israel and trumps Israel's battle for survival here. I think it's a misguided idea. There are just as many polls that show the complete collapse of support for Biden because he's seen to be abandoning Israel and seen to be weak. And there are other polls that show that Israel ranks somewhere around 537th in the issues that Americans will vote on in November. So
with the possible exception of this relatively small fraction of the population, the electorate, but let's be clear, these people are going to be emboldened by the sense that they're actually getting their way, are they not? You know the culture of this population, is certainly in the Middle East, but also arguably those that have been transplanted here.
Yeah, two things. One is...
Hold the thought, David. We need to get both of those things, but we need to get it on the other side of this very short break. Dr. David Wormser is with us, shedding light on the latest, well, I'm sorry to say it, folks, but I don't know how else to describe it, betrayal of our friends and allies in Israel by the Biden administration. We'll talk about the implications of it and more right after this. Stay tuned. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Joe Biden is running for re-election as a champion of democracy, yet he is simultaneously publicly delegitimizing, undermining, and trying to topple the democratically elected government of Israel. While the Biden administration's enmity towards Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been evident from its inception, the president is now openly defaming Bibi as insufficiently concerned about civilian casualties in the Gaza war. That's demonstrably untrue. In fact, no nation has ever conducted a necessary military campaign against an enemy hiding among and deliberately imperiling civilians with greater determination to spare innocents. Even more untenable is Biden's underlying contention that Mr. Netanyahu's policies towards Hamas are unsupported by the Israeli people. Polls show they are overwhelmingly determined, as is Bibi, to destroy their jihadist enemies, even if that conflicts with Team Biden's mounting determination to save Hamas. Mr. President, stand with democratic Israel. This is Frank Affney. We're back. Dr. David Wormser of the Center for Security Policy is with us, I'm pleased to say, to help explicate what the Biden administration is doing now further to undermine and, I believe, betray the Jewish state at a moment of existential peril for it. And I think that's not an exaggeration. If Hamas is saved by the United States government, and others, yes, but specifically by the United States government, it will put, I believe, we'll talk to David Wormser further about this, Israel in extremis. David, you were going to make two points about this situation, and I unfortunately had to cut you off, so make them address
no problem. One is related specifically to the electoral issue in Michigan and so forth. The other one's more broad, which applies both to Michigan and broadly. The narrow one is that essentially what it shows is that a very radical, progressive Bolshevik, essentially, subgroup of the Democratic Party has taken over the political structures of the Democratic Party. This is ideology, not genuinely good electoral politics.
Right. You say progressive, I've used that term with less enthusiasm than others, but I Marxist seems to me to be the operative mm-hmm. word here. But that would not necessarily describe these, Muslim Brotherhood organized front groups and their activities. But David, talk just a little bit about the common cause that these two groups make, despite some of their differences on things like theology, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah, I mean, there's a red-green alliance, and essentially it's we see it across the world. What it is they both have a deep hatred for the United States and its values and its civilization and its culture. And they find common cause.
Israel.
And Israel being sort of at the epicenter of a lot of those. It's the Judeo-Christian culture. It's a representation of Western power in the region. It's been a long, close ally of the United States and strongly identified with it. So Israel becomes the focal point of hatred for those who wish us ill. And the progressive camp, being Marxist, most of them, essentially do wish us ill. They don't believe in our system, our values, the civilizational foundations of America, and won't forgive us for having defeated the Soviet Union in the Cold War, which Israel was a part. So it sort of zeroes in on Israel in this red-green alliance. And we see lately also...
But only until it's out of the way, and then it's on to us.
Yeah, ultimately they hate each other, but ultimately that will be on our corpse. The other thing, though, the other main point, the ideology has taken over the political structures of the Democratic Party and is leading. I think it's ideology, not good electoral strategy. But the second thing is the weakness. In the Middle East, weakness invites war. The Israelis understand this about this war. They have said from day one that if they do not win it, their viability as a country in the region is in doubt. And nobody will then sign a peace treaty with them. Those who have signed a peace treaty with them will run for cover. Israel will be essentially a wounded, bleeding fish in a sea full of sharks. So Israel has to win. And the truth is, the Arab Street argument, which is often pulled out, is really the inverse of the truth for that very reason. What invites the feeding frenzy against America, against Israel, is perceptions of weakness. And as a result, if Israel does not win this war, and at this point, if there's a ceasefire imposed, Israel has not achieved all of its main objectives, and there are three of them. The first of them is the hostages are all returned, dead or alive. The second is that Hamas's leadership is dead and brought to account. And the third is that Hamas's governance of Gaza is terminated to the last centimeter and it's thrown out. And those three have been not achieved yet, but they're on the verge. All three are being on the verge of being achieved, which is precisely why there is such a shrill outcry among the supporters of Hamas to have an immediate ceasefire.
Yes, to save Hamas.
To save Hamas.
Just I want to turn to one other topic quickly with you, but is the point that will determine success or failure at this moment, do you think, the successful defeat of Hamas in Rafah?
Yes, I think that's a major defeat for the camp of Iran, for the camp of radical hatred of the West in the region, for the Islamist Sharia-based politics that's behind that. So I think that yes, Rafah falling is essentially there's still a lot of wrap-up and low-level conflict after that, but it's the last destruction of the Hamas military structure and governance structure.
And do you think that can be accomplished without mass civilian loss of life?
I think the Israelis have shown until now that they've been pretty good at it, and I think we'll be shocked at the end of the war actually how low the civilian numbers were. Right now, for example, even using Hamas numbers and Palestinian Ministry of Health numbers are Hamas numbers, somewhere around 30,000. But in a normal period in Gaza during peacetime or during ceasefire time, there's about 8,000 to 10,000 natural deaths in Gaza. There have been no natural deaths, zero recorded in Gaza in the last 6 months. So right there, you can assume that
the cycle of life has been suspended.
Right. So you can assume 8,000 or to 10, 8 to 10,000 are just by virtue of statistical consistency of the 30,000, 8,000 are just normal. And then Israel has estimated it's killed about 12 to 14,000 terrorists. So right there, you get 20 to 25,000 deaths that are either natural or actual terrorists who probably should be dead.
David, we're almost out of time. I was going to ask you about Lord David Cameron, rabid anti-Israeli foreign minister now in Britain, but we're out of time to do that. Just quickly, how will Israel respond to all of this? Will they, in fact, throw in the towel and give up?
No, Israel can't. Lose this war, and a ceasefire now is losing this war. But Gantz, essentially the opposition leader, who's part of the security cabinet, but he's the opposition leader, was in Washington, and he made that point that Israel has to go all the way.
And I gather that was not well received, and may in fact have precipitated this decision by the administration.
Correct.
To just say, "We'll take you down." Correct. David Wormser, thank you for this analysis. It's a breaking story every minute. We want you back as soon as possible. Thank you for the clarity that you bring to all of this at your work at the Center for Security
Thank
Policy.
You.
I know you'll keep it up. We'll be right back, folks, with more. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps, is aboard. He's now retired, of course, but that makes him all the more valuable to us because he's able to speak truthfully about what he sees from his perch forward deployed in Japan most days. He's a businessman out there now. He is also, in previous career positions, been a Foreign Service officer. He's the author of a terrific new book, very relevant to the present topic and our time, namely, When China Attacks, A Warning to America. Colonel, it's good to have you back aboard. Welcome, sir.
No, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
I wanted to visit with you about a topic that we'll be discussing with you and others as we speak. It will be in the hind. It is in prospect, but it will be behind us by the time this program airs. Namely, a webinar of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, to which you contribute greatly and frequently. And we're very pleased to have you with us to address this question of whether or not the clear problems that Xi Jinping is facing at home, economically, financially, especially demographically, even politically, are giving rise to any sign that he is pulling back from the kind of aggressive stance he has been adopting of late, notably towards Taiwan, but I think also it's fair to say towards us. Your thoughts, sir?
I think that for Xi Jinping, that Taiwan is such a juicy target from which he sees nothing but upside. And also he sees nothing but all his problems solved, that I think the state of his economy really doesn't restrain him from going after Taiwan. That's how I would read it. I think his thinking is almost the reverse of what a Western politician would be thinking.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the point. And, you know, one of the things that a communist leader would think is survival, of course. And it's important always, I think, to remember that, you know, there are about, what is it, 1.3 or 1.4 billion people in China, and only about 90 million of those are Communist Party members. And you throw in some more for the police and the military maybe, but it's still a fraction. And if the people of China actually decide to turn on these guys, it could be game over for the Chinese Communist Party. So how does a tyrant in the, well, the Chinese Communist, or more generally, the communist tradition, you know, sort of view those kinds of problems? Again, would it be discouraging, or would it be a cause for justifying a new crackdown, perhaps by aggression?
Well, I think that he's very different than a Western politician, and that he's not quite as worried about popular opposition, popular sort of rioting, as we would be, as a Westerner would be. He has got the forces of repression all set, and he's been using them, and he's been strengthening his ability to detect and crack down on any opposition. And this is a regime, keep in mind, that doesn't mind killing people and killing a lot of them if it has to. He is also, you know, and he's also put up with, you know, well over 500 million people in China living on $5 a day or less, and the figure's probably higher. So that is something that is would be just fatal to any Western politician in China. Well, he's been able to handle it. So I think he can put up with a lot more economic problem trouble than anyone in America ever could. And at the same time, as you said, though, you know, going after Taiwan, that may not be such a problem. One, it is kind of a distraction, but also it's a unifying force. I think that is how it would be initially.
Rally around the flag and, you know, the motherland and all that.
An element of that. Yeah.
And I also, I think that the practice on the part of these totalitarians, and it's frankly not just the communists, but any of them, they've figured out that one of the things that you can demand of people when they have to rally around the flag is sacrifice. You know, if you're on $5 a day, maybe you're on $4 a day going forward. Your circumstances may actually diminish. And that's a concern because if that's so, you're right. He's probably regarding all of this not as a basis upon which he must forego his ambitions, but he is so seized, and you've talked about this, I think, in your book, about not only modeling himself after the great Mao Zedong, in his view, but also to exceed him, surpass him. And this would be one way of doing it, would be through the taking of Taiwan. And Colonel, we've talked in the webinars a bit about this additional wrinkle, if you will, that arguably he tried a sort of proof of concept with a few years ago, namely using biological means, biological warfare specifically, to take down the United States considerably. And whether it's just biological warfare that he might resort to in this case, or the use of these large numbers of unaccompanied fighting age men from China that he's inserted into our country, or a combination of the two, perhaps, to weaken us to the point where we could not interfere with his efforts in Taiwan. It may be more of a, you know, safe bet for him to think that he could act aggressively despite these difficulties on the home front. Your thoughts, sir?
Oh, that's right. You know, if he does make a move, he's going to want to keep the Americans distracted and out of the game, keep the Americans from intervening. And one way to do that is to cause the kind of trouble that one he's already caused in the United States with the Wuhan virus, with the Chinese virus. We saw how that worked, how well that worked. But as you say, he is putting a fifth column in place in the United States. And when the time comes, it's going to cause us plenty of trouble. And don't forget cyber warfare and electronic warfare that's going to bring down our infrastructure. And he just needs a window, enough time to move. And going back to something you said earlier, you know, I think that for Xi Jinping, Taiwan is the thing that he thinks is going to solidify him, cement him as the guy with the immortals in China, who rejuvenated China, who brought back its territorial integrity, and in the process took on all of China's enemies, and they couldn't stop him, not even the United States with all its power, all its threats. Once he's done that, then I think he's made it. And listen to what he's saying. He's telling the Chinese people they just might have to eat bitterness. He's talking up the Korean War as a noble effort by the Chinese, where landing one blow and absorbing 100 saved China a whole lot of trouble. So just listen to what he's saying. And economics may matter in all of this a lot less than we think.
Yeah. Well, matter a lot less to him, that's for sure. And also, as you know so well, Colonel, the Chinese have historically, going back to Mao's day, talked rather loosely about losing 100 million people, not being a particular problem. Their families, their women would make up for it in a generation, I think, was one of the earlier leaders' expression. And we've seen some problems with the one-child policy. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, sir, is I've heard that as a result of having only one child, a lot of Chinese families are very reluctant to see them, that one child, that male child typically, put in harm's way. On the other hand, as a result of the one-child policy and the selective sex abortion, sex-selected abortions, they've got something on the order of 40 million Chinese young men for whom there are no women. And that seems like a political problem of a high order that might be resolved again by sending those guys off, maybe as cannon fodder, to fight in foreign conflicts. How do you think that nuts out, Colonel?
I think that calculation, it actually weighs in favor of an attack on Taiwan. I understand the arguments that a lot of only children coming back dead or not coming back at all would be a huge problem for a normal regime, of course, but it's a little less so for a sort of a dictatorship, a totalitarian state like China. It's something they do consider, but I think they believe the cost is manageable. Say you lost a million men in this great rejuvenation of the Chinese people. I think they could handle that. You know, they've shown they're willing to put 1 million Uyghurs into concentration camps and make a lot of others disappear. I think this is not something that's going to stop him. I know there are people who think it is. I tend to come down on the other side. Not tend to. I come down on the other side of that debate.
Lastly, sir, one of the things we'll be talking about in the webinar is the disparity between the war footing that Xi has been putting his country on, including these immense stocks of grain, for example, and they're buying more of it now. That suggests, you know, they're prepared for this fight. Might they perceive our lack of preparedness as yet another incentive for going for it in this window, especially with Joe Biden as president?
Well, I would. I suspect the Chinese can do the math as well. And as you said, they've been sanctions proofing their economy. They've been buying up oil at low prices, filling up their stocks.
Reserve.
So they are getting ready. And keep in mind that Xi knows, and anyone should know, that the Chinese people can absorb an awful lot of discomfort. That's their daily life.
It is. It's their daily life, and there may be a lot more of it in store. Colonel, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your time today, my friend. God bless you, and thank you for participating in our webinar. Check it out at presentdangerchina.org. We'll be right back. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Joe Biden is running for re-election as a champion of democracy, yet he is simultaneously publicly delegitimizing, undermining, and trying to topple the democratically elected government of Israel. While the Biden administration's enmity towards Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been evident from its inception, the president is now openly defaming Bibi as insufficiently concerned about civilian casualties in the Gaza war. That's demonstrably untrue. In fact, no nation has ever conducted a necessary military campaign against an enemy
hiding among and deliberately imperiling civilians with greater determination to spare innocents. Even more untenable is Biden's underlying contention that Mr. Netanyahu's policies towards Hamas are unsupported by the Israeli people. Polls show they are overwhelmingly determined, as is Bibi, to destroy their jihadist enemies, even if that conflicts with Team Biden's mounting determination to save Hamas. Mr. President, stand with democratic Israel. This is Frank Affney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome once again to my friend Elaine Donnelly, the president and founder of the Center for Military Readiness. You can follow her tremendously important work there at cmrlink.org. And Elaine, I had to interrupt you. You were making two key points in the wake of some of the research that you've been doing on the problems with all of this diversity, equity, inclusion agenda. Go ahead.
Well, the military used to be known for meritocracy. The only institution where blacks routinely boss around whites is my former colleague, Charles Moskos, on the commission. He used to say that and wrote about it in his book. But along
admiringly,
2011,
as I recall.
Yes.
Not,
he wrote about
a racist comment.
He wrote about how in the military, favorable. Racial differences don't matter. They really don't matter. When you go into combat, you trust the person on either side of you. It doesn't matter what color they are. It doesn't matter any more than your hair color, your skin color doesn't matter. But we have something came out in 2011.
And in fact, let me just say, Elaine, this is so important. This was really the first kind of institution in our country, as I recall,
yes.
that embraced this yes. colorblind policy long before the civil rights,
right.
you know,
President Harry Truman
movement. Yeah.
And Harry Truman did that not just to promote equal opportunity for minorities, but because it was a military necessity. They had proven themselves in war. We needed those minority soldiers in the Korean War. So the military had a reputation for meritocracy. Not to say there wasn't discrimination, but that was the aim of the institution. But along comes something called the Military Leadership Diversity Commission in 2011. This is their report. Very influential. This report is quoted countless times. Because of Obama, yes. And now the chairman of this same commission is the chairman of a new commission, Defense Advisory Committee on Diversity and Inclusion, DACADI for short. And what they're going to do is keep on with these racial percentages, even though the Supreme Court utterly trashed the whole idea, pointing out with the help of Dr. Bernstein that these categories are arbitrary. They make no sense. You throw everybody into a bin, everybody from England right down to the Iberian Peninsula, everybody, this is white, that is Asian, we'll exclude this group and we'll include that group. It makes no sense. So what I intend to do here is zero in on just how absurd this is with the help of Justices Thomas and Gorsuch. They really dug down into all this to see the absurdity of it. And yet our Pentagon is stuck on stupid. Let me give you evidence of why that is or
what
is
happening. Let me just say, just another example of the incredible contribution that Justice Clarence Thomas has made to our judicial practice and doctrines. But Elaine, before we go there, I do want to just clarify something, because as I recall about this court decision, it was Chief Justice Roberts who insinuated a footnote into his, ruling or the ruling of the court to the effect that this didn't have anything to do with the military.
Oh,
so how does this clarify what on earth is going on?
There is no carve out. People are trying to use that as an excuse. Oh, the military was deliberately permitted to continue discrimination. No, the Supreme Court does not decide cases that are not before them. All Justice Roberts said was, this will be settled on another day. But the principles that were in that opinion, and by the way, the Dr. Bernstein that I mentioned, his amicus brief was quoted by the justices in the majority opinion. So this is why it matters. They looked at these racial preferences and they said, this is nonsense. And yet our military is stuck on stupid continuing them, even though, and here's some facts to show how it hurts the military. Recruiting, we have a recruiting crisis. We've had it for a couple of years. Do you know that since 2018, the percentage of new white male recruits has steeply declined from 56% down to 44%? This accounts for the recruiting crisis in the Air Force, pilot shortages. They announced
they wanted to reduce the
number of white officers in the Air Force.
You're saying this began in 2018. This was under Donald Trump before this woke policy was being insinuated by the Obama team.
Yes.
What do you attribute those first couple of years to?
And Biden. The Biden executive orders, they include every minority group you can think of, with the exception of the white males. Because, you see, meritocracy doesn't matter anymore. What matters is skin color.
No, so when Elaine, this is important to just clarify, if I can interrupt you one more time, please. You say that the precipitous decline began during the Trump years. Was that a function of what was already happening in the academies and in the military from the Obama years, or
I think what President Trump could have done more, but remember it was the year of George Floyd. So this Dagadai committee actually got its start in the Pentagon of Donald Trump. But it wasn't the thing it is now. It was an in-house thing. Actually, their recommendations were not that extreme, but they took that base, that power base, and now have made it official, an advisory committee of the Department of Defense. And the same person who issued that report from 2011, this radical report, where he wanted to totally change the paradigm of how we train people in the military, substitute classic training techniques for inclusion. And even if there's some trouble about it, well, it's all going to be worthwhile. That same person, Lieutenant General Lester Lyles, chairs the new committee, the Dagadai, and they're picking up where the old committee left off. So this has been going on for decades.
Fourth star, as a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
But the point is that what you have been saying courageously for years, and what it sounds as though the Supreme Court actually determined, and yet what is being ignored by the Pentagon is quotas based on arbitrary features, not performance, not merit, not combat skill, is going to be the death, literally, of servicemen and women and maybe the military itself in this country
if we
find ourselves in a shooting war, which I fear is imminent.
It gives me no comfort to say is, and when I read that report in 2011, one phrase stuck out at me. It said, this is not about treating everyone the same. It is not about being colorblind. In fact, it said people who are used to colorblindness are going to have difficulty understanding this concept. I'm paraphrasing.
And our military
That's where
has,
it started.
Elaine, we're out of time, but this is a subject to which we will return with you. Thank you for this important work at cmrlink.org. Check it out. The Center for Military Readiness. Please support Elaine Donnelly and keep her voice powerfully amplified. I hope that you'll help us do the same. Until next time, go forth and multiply. We're back. And let me just say that one of the best things about being able to make these daily presentations to all of you is the chance that it affords me to speak with people that I admire greatly and have come to regard as, well, national treasures, honestly. And I think it's so important that you know of them and their work and that you understand how vital it is that we all be exposed to the kind of insights that they have and pass them along to others in need as well, including those who represent us in Congress and the White House and elsewhere. One of those most favorite people is my friend Elaine Donnelly. She is a personal hero, to be honest with you, because I've watched her over the years work tirelessly through an organization that she founded and leads called the Center for Military Readiness to try to, well, speak for the men and women who put their lives on the line for us every day in service to our country in the uniform of the United States military, and who generally can't speak for themselves under the, you know, the rules that govern our military. Civilian control, as well as, you know, the Uniform Code of Military Justice and so on. Fortunately, they do have a voice in Elaine Donnelly and in her center. And over the years, she has been at the forefront of making the case that the efforts to transform, I would guess Barack Obama would say, fundamentally transform the culture of the military is a disaster. And she's been documenting it assiduously, and I think we have been poorly served by not paying more heed to her recommendations to fix it. And we're hoping that with your help, we will do that better in the days to come. Elaine, welcome back to Securing America. It's always good to have you with us, my friend.
Hi, Frank. It's good to talk to you always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let me begin by just saying that one of the things that you've been tracking that, again, escapes much notice from even members of Congress is the Department of Defense school system, which is an enormous enterprise around the world where the kids of serving men and women are educated, or so we're told. You have been tracking some very worrying evidence of what these kids are actually being taught or indoctrinated with, one might say. Give us a quick readout on that.
Well, about a year ago, there was a lot of controversy about a woman named Calissa Wing, totally into critical race theory, whites versus black. She was wanted to teach children about racial differences and division and all this sort of thing. This is one of her booklets that was being used in the Department of Defense schools. Racism, Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, she wanted the kids involved in all of that. Well, the controversy got her fired. Actually, not fired. She was reassigned. And I predicted at the time that her philosophy would not go away because her former boss, a guy named Thomas Brady, just thought the world of her. Well, Thomas Brady is still in charge. And it turns out just about a month ago, the news came out that they just took all of her philosophy and critical race theory teaching and just spread it all over the entire Department of Defense school system, which is the largest school system in the world. Now, it's bad enough in civilian schools, but here you have little kids, their parents come and pick them up in uniform, and they've just been told that the United States is an evil country with racist founding fathers, racist founding documents. And then they're supposed to go home with their parents and not ask their parents, why are you serving this evil country, the United States of America? I mean, this is just one example, one policy in the Department of Defense that hurts common sense, that hurts the institution. We know that the children of military parents are a prime group of people who are more likely to even consider a military career. And yet the Department of Defense education activity people, they're just turning these little kids against their parents, against this country. It makes no sense. So this is only one of...
It's worse than making no sense, Elaine, if I may, with respect, say it makes perfect sense if your agenda is a Marxist takedown of, well, our country more broadly, but specifically those who fight to defend it. And dividing them from their children, fracturing the family. I mean, these are classic instruments of, well, the divide and conquer strategy, I would argue. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the bigger problem here. And that is, it's not just the kids that are being indoctrinated with this. It's the personnel of our armed forces as well. Right. And you've been doing some very important research, I understand, on what the Supreme Court has recently found in connection with a case that ostensibly didn't have anything to do with the military, but it's been read as having something to do with it. Talk us through
that. Yes. Well, the Supreme Court quoted a number of experts, including Professor David Bernstein, wrote a really good paper analyzing where did we get all these racial categories from anyway? Well, it turns out you got to go all the way back to 1978. This is the Federal Register. Five categories, white, black, American Indian, whatever. These categories covering the entire population of the world made no sense then. They were arbitrary. They were not based on anthropology or anything scholarly. And yet they have been used to divide people by their racial categories. So the Supreme Court, in their decision in Harvard and University of North Carolina, civilian schools, okay, but the rhetoric they used is certainly applicable to every institution. They called these racial and ethnic categories, they called them overbroad, arbitrary, undefined, underinclusive, incoherent, and irrational stereotypes and opaque. Tell us what you really think, Supreme Court. I mean, the problem is these categories are not only have they been used for many years, and the Department of Defense admitted that they divide people by racial categories in those cases. The Pentagon is doubling down. Back in 2011, something called the military...
Elena, I want you to hold the thought because we're going to have to take a short break here, and I don't want to interrupt this important train of thought. It's really staggering when you think about it,
yeah,
that this kind of doctrine that is, well, cultural Marxism has mm-hmm. now been not only regularized inside our society, but it is actually being wielded against the men and women serving our country and their kids as well. We're going to find out more about the costs associated with all of that and why we must end this practice. From my friend Elaine Donnelly at the Center for Military Readiness. You can find it at cmrlink.net, I believe.
.org.
.org. cmrlink.org. Right after this, we'll be back. Stay tuned.